This is a Podfic recording of Birds of a Feather by Julia Heer, read by Myfic. It's a due south Stargate Atlantis crossover, and the central pairing is Benton Fraser and Rodney McKay. It's a friendship pairing, as the story is Jen. Birds of a Feather. Part 1. Spring Migration. Benton was still shorter than his grandmother's shoulder when he realised that he was not, in fact, quite fully human. There were things that everyone around him did, and he did not do them. There were ways in which everyone around him behaved, and he did not behave in those ways. Most of the people he was around most days also looked different than he looked, but it was easy enough, from looking things up in his grandparents' library, to find out there was a simple and understandable reason for that difference. And it was, indeed, the most trivial and inconsequential of the ways in which he was different from, no different than, the people around him. The knowledge of his otherness came to him in late May, the year he turned 11. He had been invited to spend a whole night out on the tundra amidst the spring arrival of the migratory birds. His grade 5 teacher was a young woman with a young husband, a couple like his own grandparents had been, long ago, only briefly married and yet to have children, half of the teaching staff in the local school, and still new to, enthralled by, the Arctic. He and Delma were invited to accompany the teachers out away from the lights of town, to watch as the sun set and the night came, brief and barely dark enough for the stars to show. The waning moon would rise and float into the dusky sky, and then sun would rise again. The air would be full, all that time, of the sounds of wings set for landing, and wind piping through flight feathers fanned for a landing. His teacher described it in ways which made Benton think of the book of the poetry of Byron, which his grandmother kept in a locked case with the medical reference books. They sat bundled into parkas and bivouac bags, each with a steel thermos of hot tea or cocoa, and watched the southern horizon as a lighter patch of sky, which followed the sun's course below the horizon, glowed like the hands of grandfather's alarm clock. And all night, patches of moving darkness would cross that lighter sky and blend back into the darkness, or cross the face of the shadowed moon, and there would be distant whistles and twitters as the birds spoke to each other at the end of their traverse of the planet. There were 6 of them altogether, the teachers, Benton and Delmar, and 2 young hunters. Only Benton and his teacher were unarmed. Ben's only rifle, a single-shot .22, was useless against bears, and the teacher was one of the few people in Tuktoyaktuk who didn't shoot. The hunters were out for a few geese for the table, although the teachers thought that they had come along only to provide protection and to watch the first great wave of arriving migrants. Ben was bemused by his teacher's lack of understanding of the need for spring food after the interminable dried and smoked and salted meats of winter. The hunters didn't really understand, either, joking that the teachers wouldn't understand until they had a few babies and their parents decided to send baby presents instead of boxes of fruit. Delmar sat silent, watching the point to the far south-southwest, opposite where the sun would rise, his great-grandfather's Lee Enfield rifle cradled against his chest. He was much better at just sitting than Benton, who wanted to turn and watch the faces of the 2 pairs of adults behind him, to see if either of the teachers understood what the hunters were saying about them, and to understand better if the hunters were really as critical of the teachers as their words would have them be. The Inuit sense of humour made it hard, sometimes, to tell mere teasing from scathing criticism. Even after most of his life spent in the North, Ben could only tell if words were meant seriously if he could see the speaker's face, and not always then. The teachers were from the South, and worse than that, from Vancouver, and they'd come to Took, dressed in brand new store-bought clothes, all stiff and noisy, and a bit too obviously the result of a single trip down to Seattle to shop at REI, and not the kind of patched hand-me-downs and home-tanned skins which the locals wore by preference. Benton held a bird book across his lap with the same reverence that Delmar held his gun. He'd never had one of his own, and the Illustrated Guide to the North American Birds reference book in the travelling library, was big and heavy and illustrated with a set of engraved plates in the back. His teacher had loaned him her old copy of The Golden Guide to North American Birds, worn soft and floppy with use, and marked with tiny notes in black ink along the margins, telling of the time and place an astounding number of the birds had first been seen. He'd been surprised to find, when he opened the book and saw the notes, that his teacher had been younger than he was now when she started keeping record of the birds she had seen. He'd gone to the general store and bought a little spiral-bound notebook to keep his own record, searching his memory and striving to be precise about when he'd first seen a ptarmigan, a snowy owl, a long-tailed jager. He'd recognised many of the birds in the book, the geese, of course. Their size alone made them noticeable, and their markings were clear and very distinct. The first time he'd seen a Canada goose, Brenta canadensis, he noted with satisfaction at the fitness of the name. It was lying across the kitchen table, and his father and mother were carefully plucking the feathers, putting them down into a burlap bag, talking together and laughing at jokes Benton could not understand. He wondered if that counted, not that it mattered, because later that same day, his mother's birthday, he and his father went out in the soggy spring and saw the great northering flock heading along the river and out towards the Mackenzie Delta. The next spring, his father had been too far from home to be there for his mother's birthday, and after that she was dead before she made another year. Benton shook his head and sat up straight, listening. The horizon was brightening, and the bird calls were getting louder as they circled lower and lower in the paling dawn. He could hear the honking of Canada geese, and the disturbing, soulless barking of the snow geese, and through it all, the mad ululation of the big grey geese, which Benton had been surprised to hear called white-fronted. Cheeping, twittering, whistling, yapping, the bird sounds defied easy categorisation, eventually melding into a roiling chaos with no single pitch or rhythm. "Where are they coming from?" Delmar's voice came rumbling under the twittering and whistling and yodeling of the birds. "Where were they yesterday, Miss Weber MacGregor?" "These birds? Most of them were probably in the valley of the Mackenzie, up around Norman Wells or just south of there. The geese might have been on the western shores of Great Bear Lake." Benton scooted around so that he could see his teacher. "Norman Wells? Norman Wells is almost 700 kilometres from here. 700 kilometres in one day?" The teacher laughed. "Oh yes, it's not the record, not nearly so. Birds often must cross long distances between places to feed, while they're migrating. There's not much food available in the interior yet, you know." The sun was suddenly up, shining through a gap in the low hills that edged the delta, lighting the birds from below so that light reflected off the massed wings with the same intense glare of the sun on snow. Only sunlit snow lay still, and this light roiled and rippled and flickered like flames. Benton looked up and lost himself, felt as one with the beating wings, moving up and up and away from the hummock where the humans sat, moving up with the rising sun and billowing like smoke into the sky. He stood and felt as if he was flying, cold wet feet and the faint sourness and powdery taste from the dregs of his hot cocoa faded from his awareness, and he only knew the flash and flare and ripple of wings, the palpable buffeting of the sound of the birds. His mind followed his gaze up into the centre of the flight, and he felt on the edge of understanding everything, as if the world's meaning had opened up to him in the flight of the birds. He was almost there, almost ready to say the words which would explain it all, and then there were three shots. Crack, 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 and in close succession, three dull thuds. And he was back standing on the icy ground, a boy in two big trousers and a slightly tight parka, his shadow stretching out in front of him, and three grey-brown geese laying across it, as if they were stapling it to the burgeoning willow scrub. The knowledge was gone, and he was left watching his five companions caught up in their mundane routine. His teacher writing in her notebook, a strand of hair caught in her lip grease. Her husband stowing their bivouac gear and getting ready for the hike back into town. Delmar and the two young hunters tying up their geese to be carried and putting their shell casings carefully back into their pockets. None of them had seen. None of them had known. And Benton was visited with the same stark loneliness he felt when he realised his mother was gone forever. Far away to the west, the geese had all landed and were calling to each other, their necks already bent to pick the new leaves from the willows. Fall migration. Having parents had not previously inconvenienced Meredith Rodney McKay very much. His father wasn't around the house often, first of all. His job as a petroleum engineer meant he was frequently gone for a week or two at a time, so he was rarely there to play the television too loud when his son needed quiet to solve a complex equation. His mother was different than other people's mothers. He'd been made aware of that as early as preschool. She didn't expect him to provide her with cute stories to tell to her friends, nor did she feel the need to present him with elaborate toys when what Meredith wanted was books and paper and pencils and model-making materials. The arrangement had been working out well, he thought. His father earned the money that kept them housed and fed, and his mother's job paid for the school that Meredith went to for most of the day, where the teachers had already learned it was best to give children like Meredith Rodney McKay plenty of books and paper and model-making materials and calculators and access to the computer that the older students were building and answers to their questions. But in addition, to his chagrin, required vigorous outdoor exercise and also taught them about feeding themselves. He had resisted the latter two activities for most of his first year, until there was a class that taught about biology, and he could see how it was necessary, since he was an organism, that he should have to take care of his body. Terribly inconvenient, though, and something which Meredith Rodney McKay would have designed differently if he had been asked. Things were going along quite well in his life, and he had just interviewed a high school honours student to work with him on learning analytical geometry. And then one day Meredith Rodney McKay came home from school, and his parents between them caused more inconvenience in one afternoon than he'd experienced in his entire life. They stood together in the entryway, looking at each other in a suspiciously smiley-faced way, and explained to him that his father had gotten a promotion and that he would be in charge of his company's operations in a new project in Fort McMurray, Alberta, and that they would all be moving there at the end of the school term and live there for at least a year. Meredith Rodney McKay was not pleased. Not to put too fine a point on it, Meredith Rodney McKay was enraged. He had plans, and he had put a great deal of time and effort into making those plans, and even more effort into getting other people to go along with them. He had things to do, important things, and he was not going to start all over finding people to work with. He explained in great detail and greater volume about how his parents were ruining his education and destroying his chance to do real important research, until finally his father picked him up and put a careful hand over his mouth. "Mia, you're not even 6 years old yet." His father's voice was very quiet in a way which made Meredith Rodney McKay quite nervous. "Your teachers have been concerned that you're not spending enough time playing and learning to make friends. You will have a chance to learn things besides math and science in Fort McMurray, and there's a piano in the chief engineer's house, so you can keep up with that." Meredith Rodney McKay's mother moved closer and stroked his back, the way she did when he was very little and frustrated with not knowing how to say what he needed to. "Mia, sweetie, don't you see? Daddy will be making a lot more money, and when we come back we can see about having another baby so that you won't be so lonely." Mia turned and stared at his mother with horror in his eyes. A sibling? Whatever for? His mother's face showed nothing but smiley happiness, though, and he knew that he was defeated. The piano at least sounded hopeful, and he supposed he could endure a year away from the city. But what an inconvenience! His mother stepped closer and put her arms around Meredith Rodney McKay and his father, and his parents hugged each other with him in between them, and for a moment it was okay. He felt safe and cared for. But then he remembered, what about his analytical geometry? They'd been in Tuktoyaktuk for 10 months and were starting to think about packing the books and moving on to Norman Wells by the last ship of the season, when his grandparents got a letter from a friend far south in Fort McMurray. There had been some sort of family emergency, and their friend had to go to Toronto. To Toronto, of all places! To take care of a situation which was discussed only in generalities, and even then in hushed tones. There was no librarian available, and the town schools were overwhelmed with children whose fathers were working on the new oil project, and as averse as the elder Frasers were to abandon their duty to the northern communities, they could leave their library in capable hands in Fort Good Hope and travel south and do good work, essential work, in a boom town with few other cultural resources. And besides, his grandfather said, when his grandparents thought Ben was asleep, maybe it would be a good thing for Ben to be around more people for once, learn to talk to children his own age, have the educational advantage of a real high school for a year, learn about studying in a group. So they packed in a hurry and took an earlier ship, rushing to get south before the school year started. There was snow on the ground when they left Took and went coastwise to Inuvik and then up the Mackenzie to Fort Good Hope, where the willows were leafless and the ponds all frozen over. They made sure the dogs were safely boarded and helped unpack the reference collection and put the card file case back together. Then the three of them caught a bus that swayed and shook with human migrants headed south for the winter, passing the last of the southern geese on their last dusk view of the Mackenzie. And then the bus shuddered and shook up the pass and into the spruce forest, rusty mountains rising in the far distance. The bus trip was a nightmare for Ben. His grandparents were seated across the aisle, silently reading or napping or looking out the window. And Ben was in the window seat with a smelly old man sitting on the aisle. The old man had fallen asleep as soon as the bus started, so Ben was freed from the expectation of polite conversation, but he was also trapped behind a sprawl of legs and travel rug and lunch basket on the floor, and couldn't stand and stretch his legs, or maybe find another seat on the other side of the bus to look at a slightly different view. The whole bus stank. There was a chemical toilet in the back, and every time the door opened, the sewage smell boiled out and seemed to come down the aisle looking for him. There were people smoking cigarettes in the back of the bus, and after an hour or so, the reek of tobacco smoke added to the chemical toilet pong started to make Ben dizzy and nauseated. Nauseated, not nauseous, he thought, and distracted himself for a while thinking about words which were often misused. Decimated, for instance. And then there was the terrible fuzziness of confusing continuous and continuelle. Infer and imply. Latitude and longitude. Venomous and poisonous. Until he fell into uneasy sleep, his head pounding, the bus vibrating and lurching south through the darkness. Benton, wake up! His grandfather's grip was firm on his shoulder, but he spoke in his usual librarian's hush. The air was cold but mercifully fresh, and the bus was no longer jerking crazily from one pothole to the next. Ben uncurled from his uncomfortable slouch and flinched when he pulled his cheek away from the side of the bus and found it had become one with a groove on the window frame. He sat up and stretched as much as he could, pushing his fingers through his hair and arching his spine, elbows banging on the bottom of the luggage rack. "Hurry, boys!" his grandmother's voice rose sharply through the open bus door. "We've not much time." "Coming, Martha. Coming, grandmother," they answered simultaneously. And Ben and his grandfather shared a look of amused understanding, and his grandfather started toward the open door. Ben stood up and pulled his duffel bag from the luggage rack, then put it in his abandoned seat to pull his toque and mittens from the outer pockets. The movement sucked cold air under his coat, against his sleep-damp shirt and sleep-warm skin, and he shivered. He pulled on his toque and shoved the mittens in his pocket, then buttoned his coat to the top button. His grandmother snapped, "Benton, get a move on." So he left the mittens in his pocket, slung his bag over his shoulder, and started down the bus aisle at a trot and out into the cold, clear morning. "Benton, put your mittens on. Don't you have any sense?" Grandmother was standing with their trunk at the edge of the bus station platform. Ben let go of the strap of his duffel and managed to get his first mitten on before she snatched the second one from his pocket and shoved it over his fingers with more than usual roughness. "Martha, do settle," Grandfather murmured. "We've plenty of time. and we need a cup of tea and some bread before we go to the airport anyway. Plenty of time? It's a good 2 miles, George, and we've got the trunk to carry. Martha, dear, it's the modern age, and Edmund said there would be a car to take us to the plane. Look at Ben, dear. He's about to faint. Nearly got sick on that horrible trip, I imagine. I can't understand why you didn't let Edmund give us plane tickets all the way. He was quite willing. Indulgence, Mr. Fraser. Sheer indulgence. I'd not have let him plan any of the journey by aeroplane except that we'd be there after the first day of school otherwise. Benton straightened his spine, blinking the last of the sleep from his eyes, staring at his grandmother. They were going to fly? They'd never flown. He and his grandfather had often spoken of how wonderful it would be to look down onto the land and see the big picture. But both his father and grandmother thought flying was soft and lazy. His grandmother especially had barely accepted automobiles. In the end, they went into the small cafe at the bus station and had the most exotic meal of Ben's life. Half a grapefruit to start, tea with fresh milk, fried eggs, back bacon and a patty of sausage, fried potatoes, toast with butter and jam and orange juice. Grandmother tuttered when there was no porridge or bannock on the menu and was shocked when the waitress suggested cold cereal as a replacement. She finally was mollified with an order of flapjacks, which she ate without butter or syrup, but Grandfather ordered the whole breakfast special and encouraged Ben to do the same, saying that travel was meant to broaden and that meant trying new food as well. Grandfather got up for a moment after they'd ordered, and when he came back was carrying a newspaper, a real one, the Calgary Herald with the same day's date. He carefully divided the sections, and the three of them ate, and the newspaper sections were finished and passed from hand to hand, as if they were in one of their usual cabins some Sunday morning in the north. Benton felt excitement fizzing through his brains, and thought how very well they fit in this sophisticated setting. They were just finished, and Grandfather was paying at the desk, when a door with a red and white "Employees Only" sign opened, and disclosed a man in a navy blue parka and a beaked cap with a red and blue Pacific Western Airlines badge, who rattled a handful of papers as he walked toward them. "Fraser, 3 for Fort McMurray? Loading now?" he asked, even though Ben and his grandparents were the only ones left in the cafe, and Grandmother sniffed and said, "As you can see." "Your bag's ready, ma'am." "As you can see." "The footlocker and 3 duffel bags?" "So much, yes." "Well then, I see a fast flight. How long are you visiting Fort McMurray?" Benton's grandmother's voice and her back grew steely, and he could sense the gathering storm of her outrage at being questioned. His grandfather's voice was a welcome relief to the tension. "We're staying south for the school year, so you needn't help us schedule a return trip now, thank you, young man." Grandmother Fraser made a noise like a pot coming to the boil and glared at the man in the air company hat and then at her husband. "Not that it's any of your business, young man, where we're going nor why we're going there." "Martha, dear." Grandfather's voice held a familiar hopelessness. Benton could feel the heat of a blush rise up from his chest. Could Grandmother Fraser never be like other people and just let things go? The luxurious satisfaction of having eaten breakfast in a restaurant, the effervescent anticipation of the flight to come, were drowned in the feeling that everyone could see that they were strange, backwards eccentrics, with no idea how to behave in public. The airline man's laugh split the tension. "Well, Mrs. Fraser, it is in fact my business, since I'm the ticket agent, and would be the one to sell your return tickets if you were coming back within 30 days. But since you're not, I'll just ask you to bring your bags to the van out front and we'll get going to the airport." Grandmother Fraser's spine stiffened impossibly straighter, and Benton suddenly thought of a phrase in a mystery he'd once read about how swallowing a poker would only introduce unseemly flexions into a character's posture. It was not the first time Benton had found himself considering his grandmother's behaviour in terms of a fictional description of an odd old person, and while he felt disloyal to do so, he was glad for confirmation of his suspicions that she was indeed rather odd and somewhat hard to take. The airline man picked up their trunk, turned and walked out the door, and there was nothing to do but pick up their duffels and follow him. There was a beige Ford Econoline, with the air company's logo marked on the door, parked close to the restaurant door, the cargo doors standing open. The airline man put the trunk in, far to one side, and gestured to Benton to bring his bag. "Not a lot of stuff for a whole school year," he remarked, as he swung the duffel into place. I suppose you've outgrown all your last year winter's clothes, eh? Benton was stymied for an answer. All the clothing he would need for the winter was in the bag. Most of it had been his father's when he was 15 or so. One of the big trunks, kept in the rafters of their cabin in Took, held carefully sorted and labelled stacks of clothing, marked with Robert Fraser's age and the weight and height he had attained when the clothing fit. Ben was sometimes given new clothing when his father came to visit, gifts from Mrs. Frobisher or other Mountie's wives, and got new long underwear every winter. But his grandmother was convinced that a mackinaw, 2 pairs of trousers and 4 shirts, along with a couple of jumpers and a parka, was the greatest of plenty when it came to a young man's wardrobe. He was saved from having to think of an answer to the intrusive question when his grandmother swung her duffel between them and settled it into the van with a decisive thump. "Go get in the van, Benton," she snapped, and he turned and hustled off, glad to be released from the untoward interest in his belongings. The ride to the airport, with his grandmother seated next to the driver, was an uncomfortable affair. The man kept asking questions. "Where do you live, then? Are you missionaries? A library? Huh? Never thought about how people got books up there. Been doing it long?" Which Grandmother Fraser's monosyllabic replies did nothing to quench. When they got to the plane, she got down from her seat as soon as the van stopped and started marching to the back, determined to get her bag, only to be forestalled by another young man with a winged pin on his padded coat. "Sorry, ma'am, but passengers don't load their own bags. I have to be pretty careful about loading. If you could just go get in the airplane..." The driver cleared his throat, and when the pilot looked up, he made a small gesture that Benton couldn't quite translate. "You just go get in the second seat on the far side of the airplane, and I'll load your things as quick as I can." The driver did another bit of business with his fingers as the pilot took Benton's bag, and the pilot said, "Now, young man, if you could please go get in the seat next to the pilot. Have to keep the heaviest up front, you see, and you're a big lad." Benton took a panicky look at his grandfather, who nodded and smiled. The front seat! Why, Benton would be able to see everything. The cloud that his grandmother's bad mood had put over this unique and exciting morning passed, and Ben was buzzing with excitement again. Such a trip! Such a wonderful trip! Then there was a flurry of seat belts and seat backs, and gumtochew while the plane climbed so they could clear their ears. Grandmother Fraser gave a loud sniff when the gum was mentioned, but Benton noticed that she didn't refuse it. And then the pilot talked through his checklist. "I hope you don't mind. I say this aloud even when I'm flying cargo. It makes it easier for me to follow," he said. And Grandmother Fraser sniffed again. And then they were rolling down the runway, fast and smooth, the wheels rumbling underneath. And then a jolt and the rumble ceased. And they were flying, flying higher and higher, the sun bouncing sparks off the turning propeller. The plane flew east over Great Slave Lake toward Yellowknife, and the pilot tapped Benton's arm and pointed down to where the snow geese were flying in great overlapping V's, a living veil over the shining water. Part 2. Ravens and Magpies. He had been a scoutmaster for a long time and thought he was a good judge of boys, but Hal Brown had been badly mistaken when he chose the Fraser boy to be his assistant with the Beavers. First of all, the young man had no idea what you could really expect of 5, 6, and 7-year-olds. He wanted to teach them how to use axes and knives and to use flint and steel to make fire. The boy had obviously been badly neglected, even if his father was a famous member of the RCMP. He had grown up in a native community clear up on the Beaufort Sea, for goodness sake, and had been left alone to tend the wood-fired cook stove when he was a young child. Benton Fraser had no idea what a normal childhood was like. It was abundantly apparent, and his ideas were as old-fashioned and out of place in an oil boomtown as a sealskin parka was among the burgundy and forest green down-filled nylon parkas and knit toques and gloves the rest of the town wore. This hike was the boy's last chance to show he could behave in a normal fashion. They were going out to the edge of town to look for animal tracks and make plaster casts, a project he had done every first snowfall for 20 years, and one which the boys always enjoyed. Animal tracks and tree identification. Perfectly good activities on a late fall Saturday morning. and then back to town for cookies and cocoa and using Hal's wide collection of field guides to identify the tracks and learn about the animals. Time well spent, and something even the Fraser boy must find useful. Things began going downhill as soon as the crocodile of little boys and the few older scouts and a couple of parents wound their way down the carefully cleared trail out to the edge of the unbroken snow. They were in a field that had been logged decades ago and then burned over, before Hal had come to what was then McMurray, when the grade school and high school were divided into two buildings and he was hired to be the principal of the elementary school. It was away from the oil sand excavations, below the bluffs overlooking the confluence of the Athabasca and the Clearwater, well away from any hazards, and not too much of a hike from the road. If there was one thing Hal had learned from years of being a scoutmaster, it was that little boys' attention spans did not survive more than a quarter mile walk. What he also knew, and should have realised would be that much more true of the Fraser boy, was that a quarter mile walk was just a way for a teenager to overcome his inertia and get ready to really wander. They stood at the end of the cleared trail, and Hal started to give the group its directions. How they were to fan out carefully and look at the ground to see whatever spoor there was and make a cast of the best of any line of tracks. It was a lovely morning for the task, the sun still low in the east, and a bit of overcast straight up so that the light raked across the snow and put any tracks into sharp relief. There were crows making a racket somewhere off behind him, and no wind. Now, to make the cast, you need to take the can of talcum powder and sprinkle it over the surface of the snow, so that the plaster doesn't soak in, and put the ring of card around the prints you've chosen. Mix a half cup of the plaster of Paris with enough water from your thermos so that it's the consistency of thick cream, and pour it slowly down the side of the card so that it doesn't disturb the tracks. And we'll be putting flags at each cast so we can pick them all up on our way back. There was a flash of shadow on the snow in front of him, and when he looked up he saw the Fraser boy loping across the field toward the sound of the crows. "Benton Fraser, where are you going?" Hal kept his voice low and calm. He didn't wish to let the other adults, still less the children, get the idea that his authority was being challenged. Young Fraser stopped immediately and turned to face the scoutmaster. "Well, sir, I saw that this field has no tracks except those of small seed-eating birds, and I believe that if we go towards the ravens, we will have at least sufficiently large bird tracks to make good casts." Calculating quickly that agreeing with Fraser was the most efficient way to retain the appearance of control, Hal nodded and said, "Well, you go check it out, and the rest of us will follow more slowly then." Hal turned back to the main group. "Now, since Benton has done a lot of tracking, we'll take his suggestion and follow his tracks across the snow. But first, we'll use the footprint he just made to demonstrate the right technique for casting tracks." He strode purposefully out to the beginning of the Fraser boys' trail and looked down to be surprised by the track. Instead of the cleated Vibram sole which had taken over the hiking boot industry since around the time the boy was born, he was looking at an old, smooth sole, marked with metal corks, like Hal could remember his father wearing when he went hunting. How had the boy even acquired something so archaic? It was satisfying, somehow, to watch the faintly yellowish baby powder drift down and coat the print. After pushing the ring of card down around the print, he stood and gestured to the Harriman boy, one of the few in the pack who had been in Fort McMurray for a year, to come and help him mix the plaster, talking as he did and telling them to be very careful to mix it thoroughly because pieces of dry plaster would ruin the cast. The pouring went without a hitch, and the flag was carefully placed so that it wouldn't fall over the cast if the wind picked up. "Now, any questions?" One of the den mothers raised her hand. "Yes, Mrs. Johnson? How does the plaster make the cast?" "Well, basically, the water dissolves the powder, and then when it dries out, the plaster is clumped together." There was a shriek from one of the smallest boys, so bundled in his parka and hood that Hal couldn't see more than bright blue eyes and a damp, bright pink nose. He started towards the child, concerned that he'd somehow been injured, when the boy started to speak. "No! Water hardens plaster of Paris by hydrating it from the hemihydrate to the dihydrate, which is gypsum, chemical formula CaSO4.2H2O. There was no childish indecision in the child's voice, although his L's and R's were somewhat soft. Meredith McKay, that's right, the child of the new oil sand plant's chief engineer, and a notorious troublemaker already in his grade one class. Plaster of Paris is made by heating gypsum and driving off 1.5 of the water molecules from the compound, which turns it into a non-crystalline powder. When you add water, heat is released. That's how you tell a chemical reaction is happening and not just a physical mixing. The McKay child's face grew stormier and stormier as he spoke, and when his science lecture was over, he burst out, "It's bad to say not true things. Grown-ups are not supposed to lie to children." Hal did another quick calculation. There were barely enough adults to work with the number of boys he had, and he couldn't send the child home without losing a car. Bother. So many new boys. So few adults who would volunteer to work with them. Benton Fraser's voice rang out, "Oh, come see!" And Hal looked around him with a determination. Well, fine then. He'd send the McKay boy back to the cars with young Fraser, two birds with one stone. And the rest could take their time, make their casts, and do it without being interrupted by these two little honeyocks. "Meredith McKay, I'll talk with you alone when we join up with young Mr. Fraser." "All right, follow me, and I'll follow Benton's track so we can see what he has found." He set off across the field at a comfortable jog, knowing that the boys could keep up and would be better behaved for the run, distracted after such a rude outburst. Rodney was the slowest of the pack, of course, but Hal's wife was taking back door, moving just fast enough to keep the youngest boys moving as quickly as they could. There was a little ridge at the edge of the field, and the corked boot tracks ran at an angle to it, so that when Hal reached the break of the land, Benton was back a bit towards the direction he'd originally travelled, going downhill to a point where the ground once again sloped more sharply down towards the river. There were magpies perched, black and white, in the spruces along the ridge, and the black shapes of ravens sailing up and careening down just directly in front of where the boy stood. Hal slowed down a bit, not wanting to slip on the icy slope, and the scouts began to catch up with him. He gestured the first of them by, and was still 100 feet or so from where the Fraser boy stood, when the first of the other boys reached him and started to speak. "Wow, Benton, what's that?" A second boy had reached the others. "Wow!" Then a third and a fourth, all pointing and exclaiming, gesturing wildly in their excitement. Hal picked up his pace, but the first of the den mothers reached Fraser before he could and let out a scream. Everyone started to run, and when Hal reached the viewpoint, he looked down to a patch of reddened snow, ravens jumping and struggling over bits of skin and meat. "What is it, Mr. Brown? What is it?" "It's a dead deer is all, that the ravens are scavenging." He walked over to Mrs. Johnson and put a comforting arm around her. "Nothing to scream about, dear. Just the cycle of life." Mrs. Johnson pointed down at the trail of prints downhill of where young Fraser stood. "Look, look at that track." The track was huge, nearly the size of the palm of his hand, like a dog track or a coyote's, but wolf, there were wolves come down to the edge of town. "All right, everyone, we're going back to the cars now. Carefully, and stay together." "But, sir, the casts..." Fraser's voice was frankly confused. "Young man, that's a wolf print. We can't stay here with these children, it's too dangerous." "But sir, they were gone before we got here, probably as soon as we got out of our cars. Their tracks are all heading up over that way, toward the Athabasca and downriver. They left some clear marks from where they were chasing the deer, down over the ridge that's between here and town." The boy's voice was chillingly matter-of-fact, as if there were wolves killing deer a few miles from town every day. "Wolves won't come towards this many people, especially when they've nearly finished off their kill. Look, you can see that one of them has hauled off the last hindquarter. See the tracks there? How much deeper they are?" Hal could see no such thing. The blue shadows in the snow looked like any other disturbed surface to him. The young man was crazy. It was obvious that he and McKay were not good influences on the pack. The elder boys were clustered around young Fraser, staring off where he pointed, their backs to the scoutmaster. "No, and I doubt you can. Start back to the car now and take Meredith McKay with you as fast as he can run. The rest of us will follow as quickly as we can." "Sir." "Now, Benton Fraser, have you no sense?" "But sir..." Fraser started moving towards the little McKay boy, who was just now cresting the hill. But he looked back as he walked away. "It's only, if you're actually worried about being preyed on by wolves, you really shouldn't run away from them. They'll think you're something to eat. Just walk calmly and you'll be fine." Then the boy turned and straightened his back, walked calmly up to the mound of down parka and snow boots, which was the McKay child, and reached down his fur-mittened hand. Night owls. The one good thing about the house his parents had moved him to, here in this terrible town stinking of petroleum, besides the piano in the front parlour, which was in tune but did not have any sheet music, was that the back stairs went straight down to the mudroom where the washer and dryer lived, without going into the main part of the house at all. Rodney had used this to his advantage before, to go out at night and look at the Milky Way, the first new moon after they'd moved to Fort McMurray, and then his father had put a hook-and-eye latch up where he thought it was too high for a child to reach. The steps were steep, though, and it was easy to stand two steps up and stretch and unhook the latch. It was entirely ridiculous, Rodney thought, as he pulled his snow pants up over his pyjamas and sat on the mudroom floor to fasten his sorrels, that his parents refused to understand just how important it was to see the aurora. It wasn't actually much colder than Toronto up here in northern Alberta, and there was so much less light pollution. Really, it was irresponsible of them to keep him from taking advantage of the opportunity. He stretched as high as he could and sort of flipped his parka down off the hook, put it on, zipped, snapped, horrible mittens ready to go over his hands. Gloves were so much better, but his were drying in the kitchen and his parents' voices were coming under the door. No hat, bother. The hood wasn't enough, he knew. He wasn't stupid. It was minus 14 degrees C outdoors. He couldn't reach his father's extra toque where it sat on the top shelf. He looked at where his mother's hooded scarf hung, purple and pink crochet squares and white fuzzy pom-poms right next to his hand, and reached instead into the dryer where his extra sweatpants were still warm. Not perfect, but at least not pink. Waistband pulled firmly down over his ears and legs wrapped around his neck, hood jammed over it all, and Rodney was sweating. He opened the door with all the stealth he'd developed in years of going downstairs to get another book in the middle of the night, pulled on his mittens, pushed open the storm door, and carefully pushed the inside door closed before he stepped down onto the top step. He let the storm door close behind him and set out toward the edge of town, dry snow squeaking under his boots and his nose getting colder by the minute. It took much longer than he thought it would to get to the dark place out at the end of town, and his toes and fingers were quite unhappy by then. But the lights were everywhere, shifting and flaring and changing colours, and Rodney thought he could hear a crackle, a hum, like the noise between stations on the radio. That was wrong. The books all said it was wrong. But still there seemed to be something. Maybe it was data. He stood, face turned up to the sky, and tried to understand what the movement and colour must mean, forgetting his discomfort and the long walk back to his parents' house. "Hey, what are you doing out here all alone?" It was a big boy's voice, and Rodney started, angry at having his concentration interrupted. He turned and saw a looming, fur-hooded figure, black against a field of stars. Ben was about ready to run away, go back to the north and stay with Mrs. McKenzie or with Tom Quinn, or find his father and make him understand that his grandparents were just impossible and he couldn't live with them anymore. Except it was December now, and he didn't think he could survive alone and travelling overland, or hitchhike to Yellowknife and then follow the Mackenzie. Too far, too cold, too many ways things could go wrong. He didn't want to die, he just wanted to get away from Fort McMurray and go somewhere he wasn't considered a total freak. Somewhere his days weren't divided between grinding boredom and paralytic levels of embarrassment. The boredom was predictable, he supposed. School was ridiculously easy. He was reviewing material in English and French that he'd covered with his grandmother the winter he was 13, and they were in a cabin on the trail between Fort McPherson and Fort Good Hope, serving the native community as they tended their winter trap lines. French conversation was the only challenge. He found his grandmother's formal Parisian accent did not accord with Mademoiselle's Quebecoise, but that was a hindrance easily overcome. Science, which he'd been looking forward to, turned out to be a terrible disappointment. Lab science was restricted to grade 12 and 13, since the school was so crowded. Ben was officially in grade 10. His grandfather had asked that Ben be allowed to test into a higher grade, but the reply was that there was no room, and there was a waiting list for testing that dated from the past year. So Ben was stuck in basic biology, with the same books he had read when he was 7 and 8, about cell structure and energy transfer via ATP and organ systems. Higher math was, again, restricted to the upper grades, and the best Ben could say about being in geometry was that there were people there who welcomed his assistance during study group, so that it was 1 hour during the day when he wasn't under a whispering campaign about his clothing and how he smelled. His grandparents didn't understand how his thick, old-fashioned wool pants and his grandfather's old hunting boots set him apart from everyone, and how hard it was to stay awake in the steam-heated classrooms wearing heavy outdoor clothing. Grandmother Fraser especially had a hard time understanding the problem. Her idea of a school was the board and batten cabins she'd taught in as a young woman, where everyone wore their coats and the desks were drawn up in a circle around the oil stove. He took a home visit from the counsellor at the school, concerned by what she called young Benton's lack of basic hygiene, for his grandmother to allow him more than one bath a week, and grudgingly allow him to buy deodorant and shampoo and a pair of jeans and a couple of cotton flannel shirts, which he had to wash himself and dry without using the tumble dryer in Edmund's house, which his grandmother viewed with the same suspicion she applied to the toaster and electric coffee maker. Things were better for a little while, since he could go to school in his jeans and mackinaw and fit in, at least with the sons of the truckers and roustabouts. But then the snow started to fall, and even after his grandmother grudgingly allowed him to take the school bus, it was too cold to stand and wait without his parka. Without his beautiful, custom-made sealskin parka with the wolverine trim that his father brought home to him 2 Christmases ago. The only present, besides his rifles, a single shot when he was 6, and a bolt-action Winchester for his 12th birthday, that his father had ever bought him. Ben was proud of his parka, and that his father had brought him a present, and he cared for it with all the respect it was due. Because with a good parka and gloves, one could survive a blizzard on the ice, pull the sleeves inside out and the hood down, and sit on the double-furred gloves and wait for the wind to die down. A real traditional parka was a man's best friend, Quinn said, and when Robert Fraser brought home the parka, it was a mark that Ben was growing into a respected adult. And then he took it into the school building, and after an hour or two, every component part of his parka declared its organic origin. Every bit of it smelled of animal, a smell he'd never noticed before in the cold places where he had worn it, and the fishskin glue that sealed the seams could be smelled from the far end of the gymnasium during gym class. The first day he wore it, there were whispers and giggles, and by the end of the week, Ben had been tagged with a long list of nicknames, of which Sasquatch was the kindest. Benton had asked Grandmother Fraser to allow him to take some of his money out of the bank to buy a down parka like everyone else in town wore. She sniffed and said it was a waste of good money, and he could wear the excellent parka his father had made for him and be grateful for it. He talked to his grandfather about finding a way to buy one of the used ones in the thrift store on Franklin Avenue, and they decided that the best way was to write to Benton's father for permission. I'll do it, Benton. It's time for me to write to Robert in any case, and Martha won't think it strange. But that had been weeks ago, and no word had returned, and today had been the last straw when one of the boys on the hockey team had poured the dregs of a bottle of English leather over the parka as it hung in the locker room, and Benton wasn't allowed on the school bus because of the smell. Benton had come home late, and Grandmother Fraser had ordered him out to chop wood with a scornful, "Maybe that'll take the stench of Babylon off of you." And Benton had just exploded. He yelled at her about the parka and about how she was just a mean old woman who didn't understand human beings and how he hated her for making him be a freak, never fitting in. She was just selfish and wicked and evil, and he would never, ever forgive her for making him move to this horrible place. He took a lump of bread out of the larder and grabbed his rifle and bullet case and stormed off, walked away from town, away from the scarred land around the new house sites, toward the high ridge south of the confluence of the Athabasca and the Clearwater, started running when he passed into the trees, scared up a hare from a thicket of Saskatoon berries, and shot it without a thought, skinned and gutted it, gathered twigs for a fire, and made a spit for the carcass, buried the hide in the snow while the fire burned to a bed of coals, and roasted the hare for his dinner. All without any thought except for the task at hand, all without any feeling except the familiar satisfaction of doing something he had long since perfected. He sat on his gloves and ate the meat in alternating bites with his grandmother's rough bread and thought, then, that he must go back to town and apologise and ask to be sent back north, where he could do the hunting for a family with no sons and cut their wood and earn his living until the spring, when his grandparents would come back to their home. Benton started down the ridge, breaking new trail to the field where he'd found the wolf prints so long ago, wondering if there had been another visit by that pack or if they had only been passing through, following the river to the lowlands where the deer would winter on willow scrub. There were no tracks, and the deer skeleton was long since scavenged to nothing or buried in the snow, so he drifted back up across the field toward the road, and then the northern lights started to flare and flicker and cast his blue-black shadow on the pastel snow. He was almost to the road when he saw another figure in the snow, looking strangely far away, until he got a little closer and realised it was a small child, barely taller than his own waist. "What are you doing out here alone?" His voice broke the silence like a dropped plate, and the child turned and faced Ben, with his hands raised in front of his face. "I'm not going to hurt you," he said, trying to be calm. "But it's not safe to be out here alone at night without a light and without knowing where there's dangerous ice or drifted snow." The little boy looked up at Ben through ridiculously long pale lashes, and his blush was visible even in the eldritch flicker of the northern lights. "I wanted to see the aurora. There was interference on the radio all day, and the light should be really bright after midnight. It's an important part of my scientific education to observe plasma dynamics in person. The books really don't explain very well how the aurora propagates and moves across the sky, and of course that's an important part of the phenomenon." "Why didn't you go with the scouts last week when there was a field trip to observe the aurora?" Ben took a careful step toward the boy and put a careful hand on his shoulder. He was dressed properly at least, a heavy parka and snow boots and something blue wrapped around his head and neck under the parka hood, all of them new and expensive. He recognised the child then, Meredith, the one who'd annoyed the pack leader somehow the disastrous day of the wolf prints. Meredith dropped his gaze and mumbled, "Wasn't asked." Ben made out, "They don't like me." His voice was suddenly thick with tears, and Ben squatted so that he could look in his face. "They don't like me any more either, Meredith. They don't even ask me to help when it's projects I'm good at." "I'm not Meredith any more. I'm Rodney. Rodney is a boy's name. I should always have been Rodney. My parents were wrong." Ben realised that there might be worse things than a bad-smelling parka. "So, people been teasing you at school?" "School? Don't talk to me about school. It's no school at all. I'm in baby classes, finger-painting and learning the names of colours. It's setting back my educational plans. I was doing trigonometry in Toronto, and now they're teaching me to count. And I was supposed to get to take piano lessons, but there's not even any sheet music at the house, and no piano teacher in town who isn't already too busy with older students." The little boy's voice rose in indignation, and Ben remembered the tones from the days of the wolf and wondered what it was he'd said then that had gotten him in trouble. "Trigonometry? I wanted to take trig this year, and they made me take geometry. I think we're both wasting our time here, Rodney." "I could teach you trigonometry, maybe, if your parents would let me. I can't remember your name. I'm not good at names, but perhaps we could stop by and ask if I could walk home with you, because I'm cold now and I don't think I can wait for the best of the lights." There were shining streaks of tears down Rodney's face, and he suddenly sounded very much like a small boy. "Maybe, I guess, if my grandparents don't decide to send me off to boarding school or something. I've got sheet music, and my grandfather can play piano. Maybe he could teach you, even if I get sent away. Oh, and I'm Ben, by the way. Benton Fraser." He moved his rifle sling so that it was crossed over his back and reached down to take Rodney's hand. "Let's take one more good look at the lights, and then we'll go." They stood and stared up at the sky together, when all at once there was a dark shape floating down in front of them and a great silent flurry of movement in the snow. Rodney tensed and sidestepped until he was plastered to Ben's side. "What's that? Is it a wolf?" "No, it's just a great grey owl hunting lemmings, or maybe field mice here. You're lucky, Rodney. I've seen the northern lights almost every clear night of my life, and this is only the 9th or 10th time I've seen a grey owl. This was a good night for you to come out, I guess." They turned and headed out to the road. By the time he could see the lights of town, Ben was carrying his rifle in his left hand, and Rodney was balanced on his right hip, fast asleep. Another owl, a snowy this time, flew low in front of him, and Ben felt a pang of homesickness at the sight. When they got to the edge of town, Ben started following Rodney's tracks and followed them up to the back porch of a house with all the lights blazing and an RCMP patrol car parked outside. Then there was too much attention and thank yous and slaps on the back and, "Oh, you're Robert Fraser's boy." And then the constable was telling stories about Ben's father. And when he got home, there was a deep red down parka in his grandmother's arms where she sat in the rocker in the living room and stroked it as she rocked. Part 3. Pigeons. He had been sitting on the hard stone steps of the Canadian consulate for 2 or 3 hours, Rodney McKay thought, when the pigeons picking crumbs off the sidewalk near his feet brought him to something which might be mistaken for consciousness. His shoulder was stiff where he leaned against the stone post supporting the handrail, and he would have sworn he could feel his pelvic bones, ischia, singular ischium, cutting through his skin, and he shifted his weight to relieve the pressure on his bottom. It would be nice to know what time it was. There was still little traffic on the street, so it had to be before 7 or so, but in June, even this far south, the sun came up much earlier. He'd check his watch if that wasn't one of the things he didn't have anymore, along with his wallet, passport, hotel key, airline tickets, and the phone numbers of his contact person at Fermilab, and a set of directions to his job interview tomorrow, which he absolutely did not want to report missing. What he did have was a head that felt like a dropped watermelon, a mouth that tasted like the bottom of a garbage scow, and the feeling that he would never be able to get a job requiring security clearance ever again. So here he was, hoping that Canada held some sort of solution to his misery, some way to get back his stuff without screwing up his legal trail so badly that there was no chance he'd ever be hired for a project that he had to sign a non-disclosure agreement to apply for. God, he needed a drink of water. He hoped there would be a water fountain in the consulate. He hoped the consulate would open before he died of thirst. God, he needed to pee. Could you die of thirst and a burst bladder at the same time? Maybe he should have paid more attention to the soft sciences after all. One of the pigeons picked at his shoelace, and he kicked out, without much energy, and the bird retreated a few feet. There was the sound of a door opening behind him, and a big furry fast went past him, growling, and then barked just as it nearly reached the pigeon, giving it warning to take off in time to avoid being caught. The husky, Malamute, turned and walked up to Rodney, wagging its tail, and before he could gather his wits to stand, he was being licked on the ear. Diefenbaker! The voice behind him was familiar. Not just Canadian familiar, but personally so, and Rodney pushed the dog aside and stood, turning to gaze up at the man locking the consulate door 4 steps above him, lit by a sliver of morning light coming through an alley across the street. Tall, dark, and pretty much perfect, dressed in a pair of running shorts and an RCMP crest and a Chicago Police Department t-shirt. "Leave the man alone, Deef. He doesn't need your style of washing." The man turned, and Rodney was taken back decades in a moment. "Benton? Are you Benton Fraser?" Fraser looked at the man on the bottom of the steps and blinked. "Do I know you? I don't remember your face, I don't think." The man snorted. "I've changed more since I was 6 than you have since you were 15, I guess." Blue eyes and ridiculously high colour in his cheeks. 15? "Rodney? Rodney McKay? It is, isn't it? Well, what brings you to Chicago?" "I gave a physics lecture last night at the University of Chicago." "Oh, well, wonderful. Must have been a private one, though, or I would surely have seen the announcement." "Very private." Rodney opened his mouth as if to go on, and then closed it abruptly and clenched his jaw. "Is there something wrong?" Ben looked at Rodney again and was struck by how worn he looked. "Yes, of course there's something wrong. Why else would you be sitting on the consulate steps at 5 in the morning? Do come in. Deef, we'll run later." Diefenbaker yipped and trotted off down the street. "Wait, shouldn't you catch your dog?" Rodney sounded very much as if he hoped the answer was no. Ben unlocked the door and gestured Rodney in. "Oh no, he has a regular route in the morning. There's at least two bakeries where they give him broken doughnuts. I keep telling him that he's ruining his metabolism and shaming the name of wolves everywhere, but he'll have none of it. Lavatory's that way, by the way. I'll just go get you some water and start the kettle while you freshen up. There was cold drinking water in the fridge and filtered water for the kettle. Ben checked the drawer where Turnbull kept his tea cakes and took out some nice crisp almond cookies baked the day before. He stopped and reviewed the recipe. No citrus, quite safe, and shuddered at the memory of rushing Rodney to the hospital when he'd accidentally gotten a marmalade swirl at the Christmas party at Mamselle's house. Such a long time ago, and what had happened to him last night? Oh well, find out, get Ray if necessary, fix it. Rodney was standing in the hall looking confused and despairing. Here, drink this. I'm sure things are not as bad as they seem right now. I'm not sure how bad they seem at the moment. I'm still counting costs. Rodney reached for the water glass and emptied it in one draught. You're right, though. It's better when I'm not spitting cotton. What I really need is some coffee, though, if I can have that instead of tea. I'll have to grind it if that won't make your head split. We can talk in the kitchen, so we can get started on both things at once. Would you prefer drip or press? Hydrated and with his face washed, Rodney looked less physically ill, but he still looked miserably unhappy and worried. He slumped into the armchair at the head of the kitchen table, folded his arms and put his head down on the table. Ben refilled the water glass, put it down in front of Rodney, and pushed the plate of cookies until it bumped his elbow. Have some more water and a cookie, Rodney, and figure out what you need to tell me as an RCMP constable and the representative in situ of the Dominion, and then we'll work forward from there. Rodney looked up at him and at the cookies and started to speak. Ben forestalled him. Perfectly safe, no citrus at all, almond and honey baked fresh yesterday. Go on, you look as if you're starving. Ben took some time fiddling with the coffee, grinding it to press fineness, and stopping until Rodney said, "Oh, drip please," then pulsing it instead using one long cycle. Turnbull insisted that pulsing kept the high volatile oils that a single long grind cycle drove off, but mostly he was trying to give Rodney time to think. Even with creative time-killing techniques like using the cone filter and insulated carafe that Inspector Thatcher kept around for long meetings with visiting dignitaries, and swirling the water into the cone so that every particle of coffee was evenly wet, Rodney was still staring at the table when Ben turned around with the coffee on a tray, with mugs and cream and sugar. There were, however, many fewer cookies, and Ben took that as a sign that the situation was not, at least, immediately fatal. "Wait a minute, wolf? You have a wolf that you let run free in Chicago? You're still a bad influence, and they let you into the RCMP." "Well, half-wolf. And I may be in the RCMP, but you'll notice that I'm not in Canada." "True. Must be a story behind that. Which, if I were to do what I want to, I'd urge you to tell, and avoid having to expose my personal tale of shame and woe. Only I'm pretty sure that if I let it sit any longer, my problem is just going to get worse. And the worse it gets, the more likely I'm going to end up teaching high school physics in Fort McMurray. And you and I both know that's a fate worse than death." Rodney reached out and took a cup, put a splash of cream in the bottom, and filled it to the brim with coffee, then drank it in a single swallow and filled it again. "Okay, well, anyway, for my own protection, I'm going to assume you at least have classified clearance. Don't nod, I won't make you lie, I'm just going to assume you do, because otherwise I can't tell you what I lost." "I see. Can I ask you then if it's going to blow up too much of the city?" Rodney laughed and finished his second cup of coffee. "Might be easier if it was a bomb. No, not a bomb. I lost the directions to get a job interview at a secure US military facility. One so secure it doesn't officially exist. It's not the whole set of directions, but I also lost my airline tickets, which fills in the first bit of the directions, and the encoded part at the end could be broken by anyone with a little time on their hands." "Well, then it should be found. Where did you lose your things?" Ben finished tidying the counter and sat down at the opposite end of the kitchen table, finally looking Rodney in the eye. "Oh, very perceptive, Mr. Detective. You're right. I didn't lose them so much as had them stolen. And I didn't have them stolen so much as I was rolled, I believe is the correct term. I went out for a couple of drinks with a few old colleagues after the lecture last night, and then I stopped in a bar on the way back to my hotel and had a drink or two, and then a young woman sat down next to me and after that things get fuzzy, and I woke up, or came to, or whatever, on a park bench a mile or so from here. Which is also, I don't think I need tell you, not exactly the kind of thing which instills trust in the kind of people who do the hiring for super-secret military programs. I believe that's called being slipped a Mickey. Do you remember the name of the bar where you were drinking? No, not really. The first one was near the University of Chicago, somewhere on the lake. I remember thinking I'd walk to my hotel, clear my head, and then I started thinking about the lecture and the way I wouldn't be able to speak or publish if I took this new job. I really want this job, Benton. Everything else involves teaching one way or another. I hate teaching, and my students hate me. But super secret, you know. I may never be able to publish in my lifetime. And I got chilly. The wind off the lake, you know, and I thought I'd go in and have a drink. Nice place, looked all respectable and sort of British. A whiskey place, I think. I was drinking Del Finney and the Macallan. Glenlivet, probably, if I remember right. 12-year-old single malt, you know. Very nice stuff. And the young lady who came and sat beside me was quite nice too. Blonde, very nice. Pretty, not too thin. Ah, well, I think I know just where you mean, and I expect that we need to go to your hotel and see what was stolen. And I think, Rodney, that we need to ask a friend of mine with the Chicago police to help us with this. No, no police. If there's a police report, I won't ever see another top secret job application.
No, not a report.
Just a little help. We need a ride for one thing, and we need to get to this young woman before she finds a buyer for your papers. She's a spy. Oh, God, she's a spy. I'm dead. I'm utterly dead. Completely, totally dead. I will never work again. I'll end up a janitor at the Fort McMurray High School. No. If the young woman is who I'm almost certain she is, she's not a spy. Just a thief with a wide distributorship. And I'm sure I'll be able to get you a job teaching physics in Inuvik, at least, if you can't find work elsewhere. Rodney looked at Benton and blinked. Rodney, relax. Even if this woman is smart enough to recognise the value of that information, she doesn't have connections in the spy world. We can find her before she can find a buyer. I'm not going to make you move to the Arctic to find work. Well, good then. I hate the cold. That's why I'm trying to get work in where I'm going. I never want to wear fleece again in my life. Oh, and my flight leaves at 8 tonight, just to make everything a bit more stressful. Drink your coffee and eat your tea cakes. There's some other food in the refrigerator if you want. Lots of cheese, for one thing. I'm going to call my friend and get dressed so we can get out of here before Inspector Thatcher comes to work. It's easier to write a note and tell her I'm off dealing with a Canadian citizen in distress than to get her permission beforehand. It was a good thing that there were plenty of almond cakes and that the cheese in the refrigerator included brie and there was a loaf of thin-sliced pumpernickel to eat it with, because it was the last food Rodney saw until he landed in Santa Fe the next morning. A skinny guy in a black muscle car and a leather jacket, looking less like a policeman than Rodney could imagine, pulled up to the curb and scattered the pigeons from their rummaging in the gutter at the very moment when Benton, in full red parade uniform, which seemed to Rodney to be the last thing to wear when one was trying to catch a professional thief, unless the thief happened to be blind, stepped out of the consulate door and locked it behind them. Rodney got into the back seat on the passenger side, and just as Benton closed his door, it was again Big Furry Fast coming in through the driver's side window, and he was sharing the back seat of a two-door car with a half-wolf. Then it was a confusing day of chasing about. His hotel room had been ransacked, but nothing was stolen, because the only thing he'd had of any value was his laptop, carefully stowed in the concierge's desk safe. Benton packed his suitcase with blinding speed, and the detective made a couple of phone calls. One to his boss, apparently, saying they had a lead on Tulip, and then they were charging off to the place from last night, coincidentally called the Whiskey Club. New guy? Yes, I hired him last week. I'd recommend firing him. He's working with Tulip. And then the bartender's house, where he was stupidly home with his wife, who was not pleased to hear of Tulip.
You told me you were going straight this time.
As they left for the address the bartender gave them, his clothing and golf clubs were flying out the front door along with some very colourful and painfully loud language. And then a foot chase, which ended with Diefenbaker sitting on the young lady of last night's adventure, who was still in possession of all his stuff and so far from understanding the importance of the directions that she'd used the back of them to write her grocery list on. And then things slowed down quite a lot, as Tulip had several outstanding warrants, including one to search her premises for a long list of other stolen items, including, for some inexplicable reason, 6 dozen racing pigeons, glowing like jewels in a coop in the backyard. Rodney sat in the car and waited, and took a long nap, only to be awakened quite late in the day to make a quick run back to his hotel to shower, shave, and get into clothing not covered with wolf hair, and then go off to the airport just in time for his flight. Pelagic species. You know, I really wanted to fly a cloak jumper in and land at the Golden Gate Park, just so I could say, "Remember where we parked?" for the fun of it. John Shepherd grabbed the railing on a high balcony and stretched and dropped into a crouch, his back making a series of truly disturbing cracking sounds. Or at least stay close enough to the coast so I could go surfing. Rodney looked across a narrow strip of water at the rocky islands in front of them. I just thought we'd at least be able to rig some secure transport so we could go eat at some restaurants, take Taylor shopping downtown, and have a little vacation and a bed and breakfast somewhere. The "with Jennifer" remained unspoken. Jennifer Keller had been the only one of them to finagle leave and had taken off for Wisconsin as soon as she could get away in case Stargate Command changed its mind. Everyone else was considered either essential to the repair of Atlantis or a security risk, or implicitly both. So they were all at anchor, just off the Farallon Islands, with the lights of San Francisco on the eastern horizon mocking them every night. Instead, we get stuck over an abyssal ledge, watching seabirds catch sardines to feed their chicks and smelling the result when the wind is wrong. It wouldn't be so bad if we'd been here in October. I hear it's like Shark Week then. As it is, we're in one of those boring episodes of nature that people only watch when the Daedalus is a week late and we've seen everything else a dozen times. Gee, McKay. I'll make sure the next time the Wraith attack Earth, they do it when you can watch Blood in the Water, Elephant Seals versus Great White Sharks, in real life. Well, there's a party of inspectors from the IOC coming into the gate room in 5 minutes. Perhaps we can convince them that Atlantis shouldn't be a floating equivalent of Devil's Island. Shepherd and McKay turned to find Richard Wolsey standing at the door to the balcony. One of them is Canadian, Rodney. Maybe he'll be sympathetic to your need to eat in a good restaurant. Well, if he's from Montreal or Vancouver, with our luck we'll end up with some oil guy from Alberta whose taste buds have been killed off by living too close to the refinery. I hear he's an RCMP officer. Does that make a difference? Shepherd piped up. I don't know. The only Mounties I've ever met have been worse tight asses than DC Marine Guards. Well, be that as it may, we need to be in the gate room in 3 minutes and 20 seconds to greet the inspectors, so I suggest you come with me now. They were silent in the transporter. All of them had bigger concerns than the smell of digested sardines. It was becoming more and more obvious that the International Oversight Commission, as well as most of Stargate Command and some powerful factions in Homeworld Security, all wanted Atlantis to stay either on Earth or, at the very least, somewhere close by in the Milky Way galaxy. The To Hell with Pegasus faction was still in control, apparently, and they considered quarterly patrol cruises by the Daedalus a sufficient presence to prevent any other incursions by the Wraith or whoever else might find out about Earth and attempt to gate in and cause trouble. As far as they were concerned, Taylor and Ronan could go back to Pegasus on the next patrol and do whatever it was they did there. They were no part of the Atlantis expedition's original scoping document and no particular concern of the managing agencies. Just before the transporter doors opened, Wolsey spoke again. Rodney, I hope you will keep your opinions about Alberta to yourself and work cooperatively with the IOC representative. I too hope that we can resume our mission as it was originally conceived, and I want us all working towards the same goal. They walked into the gate room just as the activation sounded. There were a woman and 2 men in indistinguishable charcoal business suits and business-like expressionless faces, and, just beside them, a stalwart figure in scarlet serge. Rodney blinked and then smiled at the familiar face. Mr. Wolsey, I'm sure that the new Canadian representative and I will have every probability of working well together. It seemed a waste of energy to take the Stargate from Colorado Springs to the Alpha site and then back to Atlantis, but Ben could see how the trip would impress people who had not read their briefing papers. The experience of gate travel was fascinating to experience, of course, but it would have been just as interesting to travel in a cloaked spaceship. There seemed to be an interest among the people who'd planned their trip to restrict knowledge of certain aspects of the Atlantis technology. Nothing could have prepared him for the Atlantis gate room, though. Not after leaving the dingy concrete of the main Earth gate room and the cobbled-together assemblage of the Alpha site. He'd been in some of the great constructed spaces on Earth in the past few years, but the shimmering colour and soaring spaces of Atlantis were a revelation. He trailed after their guides, Richard Wolsey, who he'd spoken to briefly last winter when he was first appointed to the IOC and Mr. Wolsey was readying himself to leave for the Pegasus Galaxy, assisted in turn by Colonel Shepherd and Dr. McKay. Rodney had understood Ben's slight shake of the head in answer to his surprised smile of greeting and played the disinterested acquaintance quite well for the whole tour. There was the usual stiff and useless formal dinner in the expedition leader's conference room, where Lieutenant Colonel Shepherd and Dr. McKay were asked an assortment of politely and subtly condescending questions about their latest world-saving activities, to which they gave short, gracious, but incompletely informative answers. By the end of the soup course, Ben began asking questions of his fellow IOC members, and Mr. Wolsey soon met his eye and gave a small nod and nearly invisible smile. Their personal and political agendas soon began adding up. It was very like a police interrogation, disguised as dinner table chit-chat, and by dessert, it was clear where the fault lines lay between members of the committee. Who could be safely ignored? The blustering Russian, who had no clear idea of what the city of Atlantis could do and thought it should be permanently stationed in the Arctic, and expected Fraser to agree with him. "Because I hear you are by birth a close neighbour of our eastern Arctic, yes?" And who was the most accepting of the idea of letting Atlantis go back to the Pegasus Galaxy? The EU representative, who General O'Neill had told him was a personal friend of Mr. Wolsey's, though neither of them betrayed that in their interactions over dinner. The military and science staff excused themselves after coffee, all of them having carefully foregone most of the wine and brandy. Fraser stood soon after and apologised, saying that he was not used to so much food at late hours and needed to take a run if he were to be able to sleep that night. "Sergeant Fraser, please allow me to ask one of the expedition staff to go with you on your run. We haven't repaired all the battle damage to Atlantis's perimeters, and I wouldn't want you to be injured." Wolsey tapped his ear and said, "Colonel Shepherd, would you come and meet Sergeant Fraser outside the conference room, please? I'd appreciate the favour of you or Ronan taking him for a run, so that he doesn't accidentally fall in an impact crater." Fraser bowed to the guests and stepped through the door, expecting to have to wait for a moment, but Colonel Shepherd and the looming young man in dreadlocks, to whom he'd been introduced, briefly, as Specialist Dex, were standing just outside of the door, along with his old friend Rodney. "Benton, I couldn't believe it when I saw you. Last I knew, you were exiled to consular duty in Chicago. Come on, do you really want to run? Because if you do, you'll need to stay inside. There's a gale building outside and the piers aren't safe at all. This is John Shepherd, by the way, who's as good as you at annoying his superiors, and Ronan Dex, who doesn't admit to having any. Taylor is asleep, I'm afraid. She's catching up so that when she goes back to her baby on the Daedalus next month, she'll be ready to keep up with him. Ah, I wondered when I read the files how she could have left her home and child." Fraser gestured toward the nearest transporter, and the four of them started toward it. "Sergeant Fraser," the colonel's voice crackled with tension, "that's what we want you to understand. Atlantis is home for all of us, and the Pegasus Galaxy is where Atlantis belongs." "I'm interested in what you have to say, but perhaps we could find somewhere more private to converse. If I could go back to my room and put on something a little less conspicuous, and then we can talk at least, if you don't want to run." "These two need the exercise worse than you do, I'll bet," Ronan smiled down in approval. "We could run to the West Botany Lab, stop there to talk. It's about a mile round trip, not really far enough, but it's empty this time of night. I'm tired of being trapped inside, and at least it smells good." "It's enough to get the kinks out tonight. Could we perhaps have a longer run in the morning? I'd like to see the whole place, if I could, without the desk types keeping us under roof. And while we run, Rodney could explain why he stopped writing to me when he went to Siberia."
"Oh no, 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 no. No, you don't. I was trying to keep you from teasing me about having to go back to the cold. Also, the Russians read every word that went out of there, and I didn't write to anyone after I sent a letter to a friend asking to be sent Timbits, and it came back to be marked up with black lines. I'm not going to tease you about Siberia. You went to the Antarctic next. Your career makes mine look positively tropical by comparison. The run out to the botany labs went on in that vein, Rodney and Fraser's stories interrupted by rude questions from the other two men. Sweatpants on your head, McKay. I guess you've always been fashion forward. You jumped out of an airplane without a parachute? Hey, Shepard, I think we've found someone with less sense of self-preservation than you, even. When they arrived, and the scent of warm earth and green things... Wait, Ronan, are you sure this isn't the greenhouse with those plants from M138B that make me itch? Surrounded them. They fell silent as they walked between benches laden with enticingly unfamiliar plants to the office area at the far end of the greenhouse. Anyway, Benton, does being appointed to the IOC mean you're finally out of trouble? Rodney landed at the grey enamelled steel desk and started poking at a laptop sitting there. You do notice I am once again not in Canada, don't you? Benton sat at the end of a sagging maroon plush Chesterfield and wondered how such an object had found its way onto a space station. What did you do this time? McKay glanced up at him, then turned his gaze once again to the laptop screen. In fact, I just finished a long investigation into RCMP weapons training programs and made a series of suggestions to improve education and emergency response in dealing with agitated subjects. So, they kicked you upstairs then? Yes, as you say, they kicked me upstairs. It's a fascinating position, but as I found out after I took the appointment, the Canadian representative to the IOC spends a great deal of his time fielding complaints about Rodney McKay, and complaints from Rodney McKay, and of late, answering email from Jeannie McKay Miller. Oh no, not really. I hardly ever write to the IOC anymore. I'm too busy. True, but there are, in fact, unread files dating back to your first month in Antarctica. I told my predecessor that it was a position in which I had field training. She was amused to find out that you'd been a child. There are theories that you'd sprung fully grown from a computer terminal. John Shepard cleared his throat and looked Fraser in the eye, and suddenly looked every inch a military commander. So, Sergeant Fraser, what do we have to do to get you on our side? Well, I'd greatly appreciate the chance to stay on Atlantis for a while. I've always wanted to visit the Farallons. They're a fascinating environment. Although my official brief is to promote the use of ancient technology to locate and safely isolate or remove a great deal of nuclear waste which was dumped in these waters during the 50s. Current terrestrial technologies do not have that capability, and it would be to your long-term advantage to do something obviously beneficial to Earth while you're here. In other words, we'll have to wait until the next wave of Wraith or Replicators, or those renegade Asgard, take out the Daedalus and we get their death signal 15 minutes before the invading force hits the Milky Way to go into space again, let alone back to Pegasus. Rodney shifted his weight nervously and looked at the Colonel. Don't remind me I said that when it happens, okay? I know I should never let out my worst fears because they'll happen 5 minutes later. Shepard, who was leaning with one elbow atop a filing cabinet, gave Rodney the look of fond exasperation Ben had seen on the face of every adult who had finally come to appreciate him, and drawled, Right, Rodney, because nothing bad ever happens just after you say, It's a lovely day, nothing could go wrong on a day like this. Ben smiled, and then said in a low, solemn voice, which he hoped communicated his implicit meaning. I can't say anything officially, Rodney, but there are those who agree with you. It's just that there are many more who want to use Atlantis for other reasons. But I think it would be a good idea for me to stay here, just as a guest, so that I can study the rare and endangered species on the Farallons, and keep a close eye on the progress of the nuclear waste study, report back to my superiors, you know, keep everyone informed. Keep which everyone informed, Benton? Keep the people who want us stuck here informed, so they can keep Pegasus cut off and undefended? Keep the thousands of ancient sites we haven't investigated just sitting there for the next science fiction supervillain to find and use against us? Rodney turned on his stool, and there was a ghost of reflected aurora in his eyes. I delivered a baby, Benton, and he's out there right now without even his mom, because we came here to help the Earth, and now we're stuck here. Well, Rodney, you know, I've always been interested in everything with wings. The Farallons have ashy petrels and storm petrels and three kinds of cormorants and all sorts of other birds which don't usually come this near to the mainland. I think they should all live to fly free. You can make of that what you will. The end.